Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinterillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too. Hi, and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn, and today, really excited. So we've been a bit delayed, but we've got there. It's my fault. I have Mark Convey on with me. Would you like to say hello, introduce yourself, and tell us a little bit about what's brought you on today?
Sure, will do. Thank you, Tara, for having me on. My name is Mark Convey. I'm 47 years old, live in Brighton, and I'm a bit of a storyteller at heart. So I spend a lot of my life telling stories for other people. And now I've gotten to the point in my life where I'm sharing my own story and the lessons from it. And as your viewers can probably see, you know, I've been through some adversity in my life. And it's an incredible resource for me to tap into my own story. So I'm hoping that I can help other people see the strength and the gifts in their own story and be free from any fear of them. And if I can inspire them to do that, by the way that I've dealt with mine, then it's just going to give my life a lot more purpose and depth and meaning.
Oh, and that's what I'm all about. So your premise fits my podcast, that what have we got in us kind of organically due to our life experiences to help us cope. It's not always about external means of support, because I think we forget how incredible we are as humans sometimes and when we face adversity. But what I also love is you just mentioned it again there, facing fear, but having purpose, value-based living. Because sometimes when we've been through really adverse things, it can impact how we see life and how we engage in life. So that's why I was so excited to have you on. So thank you for making the time, because I know you're super busy. I follow you on LinkedIn, always doing interesting, amazing things. So to make the time to come on here is absolutely fantastic. So where would you like to start? Do you want to start with your story? At what point in the story shall we start at?
We might as well start at the day where everything changed and my life took a very different direction. I could spend hours on here telling you the story, so I'll try and give you the briefer version. I was 14 years old. Unfortunately, cliche, kids playing with matches and caps and in a vicinity too close to petrol. And a can of petrol caught fire. I got trapped inside a garage adjacent to my uncle's house in Ireland when I was on holiday. I was only 14 years old, got trapped in the garage, managed to escape from the garage when it was burning all around me. I had a crazy near-death experience while I was lying on the floor in the garage where I chose to live. Escaped from the garage. My uncle managed to get me to the local hospital where they stabilized me. Then it was a cross-country trip across Ireland to Dublin. I flatlined twice on the way in the back of the ambulance. Wow. Made it to Dublin, stabilized me there. I was in one coma, came out of a coma. They gave me penicillin, which nearly killed me again. So I had to go back into an induced coma, survived that, managed to get back to England. And that's when the long road of rehab really started and really intense. I was very lucky to be in a world-class burns unit in Roehampton, Queen Mary's Hospital in Southwest London. It's not there anymore, but when I was there, it was probably one of the best units in the world that I could have been at. So that was amazing.
Wow, yeah.
But it was relentless. It was, over 30 operations in total, but 20 of those coming within the first 6 months, and then having to wear pressure garments and a plastic face splint for 2 years for 24 hours a day. So it was quite a lot to go through as a teenager, but hopefully, as we'll go on to see, over the course of this podcast, it was something that made me and didn't break me.
So as I say, sometimes people talk about having a singular adverse event. Sometimes it's a series of multiple things, and people might think that the fire is the event, but actually your journey had many, many different facets to it. But also, that's a critical time for kind of brain development, social development, isn't it? Those early teenage years, what it meant they'd be having those number of surgeries, the recovery time from each kind of course, and the kind of impact on you being a teenage boy.
Yeah, living absolutely. Life. And it's, I'm glad you touched on the age and that they're still developing, because in one way, people sort of look at my story and pity me more because it happened when I was 14. But right. There's a flip side to that, that if you get things right in the times after such an adverse event, then I was so neuroplastic still at that stage. You know, I was just going, you know, starting going through puberty. So I was going through the second biggest growth spurt in my life, where I can make all these neural connections. And what they did was created this unbelievable foundation to me in terms of strength of character to just enable me to get through the situation I was going. But then they don't just turn off after that. You're left with them then, and then you can benefit from that from the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And face those future adversities that might be less, but they're relentless and they keep coming and keep coming and keep coming, and stuff that you need to deal with every day.
Because the other thing that kind of struck me when I was reading your story, when we talked before, haven't we, prior to kind of booking this today, is that there may be that kind of level of uncertainty. It's not, you know, if you break a leg, there's much more of a kind of a linear pathway of how bones heal. But with injuries such as yourself, that kind of level of what's coming next, what it looks like, you wouldn't have known at the time there will be this many operations and this in between. Is that, you know, how you kind of live your life, is the right to ask around that, not knowing what might be next, and making life decisions, I guess, around that.
Yeah.
In terms of school and education, where you live, what you do.
I think it was so relentless that you couldn't look too far ahead. And again, that's one of the sort of the early gifts, is that the only way I could cope and my family could cope was just to live in the moment and deal with things bit by bit. You know, my first week back in Roehampton, I had this incredible consultant, Dr. John Clark, but he was, you know, he straddled the line between madness and genius. Wow. He was a very old school belligerent character, but he was a total pioneer. So even though he didn't really know what he was going to do in the next month, because he was constantly pushing the boundaries. But also, you know, my first week back, I had an operation on the Monday, an operation on the Wednesday, an operation on the Friday. And, you know, between the end of September and Christmas of 1992, I had 17 operations just in that period. Now, if I'd known that that was ahead of me, then you would just fall apart. So sometimes actually not knowing the road that was trodding, and because it was in an era of incredible innovation within this space, that everything was new, cutting edge, and it kind of still is to this day in the area of burns and burns treatment. And so it wasn't really a roadmap that someone else had followed even a year before me or 2 years before me, because things were moving on so fast. And actually, that was something that really played into who I was and how I coped, and how I wanted to help create a future that I could see for me, and loving proving people wrong. We'll probably go on to talk about character traits in a bit, but it kind of played into my strengths, not knowing there was no fixed path, and that suited me.
Because I think sometimes, you know, when we just look at this kind of psychology of the brain, physiology of the brain, you know, the role of threat mode, our brain wants certainty. It wants to know. It would love it if we woke up and the rest of life was just a day in a diary with exactly what's going to happen, because it kind of thinks then everything's going to be safe. But life isn't like that. And actually, sometimes it is easier to just be in the moment, because brain can very easily fast forward and try and work out exactly what's going to happen. And it can be quite tiring, but it can also mean that maybe you do miss little present moment awareness things. You know, how am I doing in my recovery? What am I noticing about myself, my personality, how I'm facing this? Is it all right to bring in now just a little bit in terms of what was the support around you like? How did that factor in, especially in those early days?
It was unbelievable. It was. I mean, and I think I needed it as well. You know, it was a perfect storm, really. You know, I had a very stable upbringing. Parents are very, very family focused, and they're both Irish Catholic, so there was a real sense of strength via their faith, and the fact that we were living in South London, and there's a very big sort of Irish immigrant community that is like a family in itself, because all of us kids growing up, not a lot of us had extended family around. So therefore the friends that you made via school, but really via the church, became your cousins. Yeah. And, you know, I've said often in speeches that, you know, they say every child should be raised by a village. I feel that since the age of 14, I've been raised by a city. So it wasn't just the tight family unit that I had around me. It was the extensions of that, the friend, the community, everything was geared. And very, very fortunate that my parents were two people that paid an awful lot forward in our community. You know, we always had a very much an open door policy. And I always just thought it was normal that there's always kids coming around and people come around to see my mum and kids staying over. But, you know, my mum was one of the go-to people that people would go to with their problems. Wow. And, you know, my dad's incredibly generous at giving his time and volunteering. So when, without ever expectation of wanting anything back, but little did they know that when they really did need that support around them, because, you know, I saw them, and then they had to hold themselves for me. And then there were people behind that, them holding them. And that just went back and back and back several layers. So it was quite extraordinary to witness. And and then that gives you strength as well, right? You feel like that you're not just doing it for yourself, you're doing it for other people as well.
Yeah.
So even in those darkest of moments, when you think that you're a drain on resources and, you know, you're ruining everyone else's life, really, no, you can become that beacon of hope. And if you see that and the people around you show that to you, then it can give your life that sense of meaning and purpose, even when you're lying in a bed, you know, not being able to do much at all.
So coming back to what you said before, that fear, that uncertainty that you're holding on the one hand, and we know, don't we, sometimes people think of kind of hope and compassion as a little bit more kind of alternative or woo-woo, but there's a big robust science behind hope and compassion and what it does to the mind and the body and outlook. And I'm just thinking as well, actually, because I'm a parent, you do anything for your kids. So sometimes you shield and hide your own stuff, don't you, for them and want to, and that can be a lot to do. So how wonderful as well that your parents also had the community and the support of people for them, as well as you kind of having that hope and support yourself, and what that might have done to mind and body in terms of healing as well, and not just coping kind of psychologically as well. So along your kind of journey, what have you noticed? I really want to bring in character, because that's the thing that really got me interested about this episode today of you're facing that fear, you've got all of this uncertainty of doing your best to just live moment to moment. What do you think that did for your kind of character development now as an adult? What you've taken from that about how you live your life?
Well, 100% in some ways I had to grow up overnight. So at 14 years old, in certain sense, I had to become an adult as we see it, or as we've been told. That's for sure. The honest answer is, in terms of my character, that I didn't change at all. What changed was the context of the life I was living.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've done an awful lot of kind of reflective work over the last 2.5-3 years since I've made a decision to look back and tell my story and extract the lessons from it. You know,
it was quite a short period of time. Is that right to ask then, that you've kind of decided to reflect and really look at this?
Yeah, I waited 30 years and, you know, I waited 30 years because I was out there, as I call, like running into life. And even in up the score with the universe, you know, once I got to a point where I got my independence back, I was just, so much has been taken away from me in the last 5 years. Yeah. I'm going to spend the next however many years just living my best life and full of adventure, and not in a selfish, narcissistical way, because, you know, I think I've always added value to communities. It's within me and how I've been brought up. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to go and do what I want to do and have great adventures. And then it took 25 years of me running into life, adding life wisdom, falling down, stumbling, learning, getting back up. And then one day just realizing I'm kind of done running into life now. It's time to look back. And the next era of my life is looking back, is reflecting. And I've got 25 years now of, you know, sort of normal life, like wisdom, to add on top of this 5-year recovery journey and put all that in a mix together, then I feel like I have a kind of a, you know, a sense of a kind of a, not an authority, but a hell of a lot of knowledge around, you know, overcoming adversity and resilience and what it takes to be our authentic selves. And then now that kind of loops us back quite nicely to what you, how you asked this question in terms of my character. And I look at who I was just before the accident, and I had all these character traits in terms of very stubborn, competitive, quick-witted, a mouth that would talk before the brain engaged. All these, and all these things were powerful tools, but there were things that were just getting me in trouble because I just didn't know how to handle them. And so many of my character traits, especially compared to my siblings, were, you know, dialed up to 11. And it was, try to put that into a 13-year-old boy who should be studying in school and paying attention and not winding up people around him, and then, you know, having to run away before, you know, getting hit by the bigger boys or whatever it may be. It was just, I was a bit, at certain points, too much. Yeah, I was a nice kid as well, and I was never mean, but, you know, I could be probably quite annoying at times. Now, suddenly, I'm in a context where I'm fighting for my life, and that stubbornness and the competitive come to the fore. And thank God I was able to turn them up to 11, because, you know, when you've got a 3-4% chance of survival, you want to stick around, right? And then come to the recovery. And this is another reason to be so grateful for those around me, not just my family, but the medical team as well. They all, rather than being saviors, were empowerers. So they empowered me to tap into what I had. So suddenly being able to be competitive and stubborn, always curious as well. I was one of those kids, why? And my dad was one of those dads where, because I told you so, son. And now that could look like a bad dad, but for someone like me, it's exactly what I needed, because of that stubbornness and competitive. I wanted to know. So it developed this side of my character where I just wanted a thirst for information. So I was, from the moment I woke up from the coma, I wanted to know every detail, super interested. That curiosity in my own recovery gave me the information. And then I had these character traits that at a certain point, I started to leave my own recovery and make my own choices and be backed up by my family. And then I had this quick wit and dark personality. So I was able to, even in the darkest moments, you know, create an atmosphere around me, you know, with the help of others, that was often quite jovial when the times went dark, and I would create an environment where people would want to look after me. So all of a sudden I'm just being my authentic self, and people were, are not trying to tell me to be quiet, to do that, to study hard, trying to restrict who I am. Suddenly I just grew into who I was at a very, very early age, which not a lot of people get to do in life. They spend decades searching for that, and then suddenly, bang, I had to learn that just to survive. And
that fight to want to survive as well. Because, you know, when we look at what you've been through, that could severely impact someone's hope, outlook, recovery. What is really interesting, because, you know, humour is widely known to be a kind of a good way of coping. It creates a little bit of a kind of distance from reality. It can sometimes help us manage a little bit better, especially dark humour. But also it can put people at ease as well. And sometimes, especially kind of in British culture, we're not so great at sitting with tricky stuff compared to our kind of Northern European or American counterparts. So sometimes people want to overly rescue or fix, or they pull away because they don't know what to say, don't know how to respond, they don't know how to be around distress. And humour can sometimes just help people, I don't know if that's something you've noticed, kind of sit better with distress.
Big time. And I noticed it very early on as well. So and I don't want this to come across that this is all plain sailing and I cope with it. You know, there were lots of dark times and doubts.
Sure,
and
people
needed to pick me up off the floor, and it was, you know, one step forward, three steps back, three steps forward, one step back. It was not, you know, linear in any way.
Yeah.
And it's too easy sometimes to look back through rose tinted glasses and see it in a one way. But that is not a bad thing in itself, because that just shows you how you've recovered from a set situation and how your consciousness is allowing you to remember the things that you can now use going forward and let go of the things that don't serve you anymore. Yeah. But yeah, I was super cheeky, like from the very first moment, and knew I could get away with it. So it was good. But then, you know, when I broke out of my little bubbles and was able to say walk around the hospital and come face to face with people that, you know, hadn't seen me or I wasn't comfortable with.
Yes.
Then, you know, there was a period where, you know, I would, you know, stare them down till they looked away and be like quite, you know, intimidating and forceful walking around. It's like, how dare you look at me and these kind of things. And then one day walking down the corridor, someone looked at me and I just saw like pain in their eyes, and I just smiled, and just that smile just completely changed their face. And there was this connection built between the two of us. And I was like, wow, you just did that with your smile. And it's like, okay, you're going to need to be a bit more proactive if you're going to bring yourself back out into the world. And, you know, if you don't want to see yourself as a freak in any way. And so it made me realize that I could have control over and needed to have control over those initial social interactions.
I was just thinking that when you look at how much autonomy you would have had versus in that moment going, what is in my control here?
Yeah. And that was in my control. And I thought, okay, you have to stand up and you have to put people at ease. And then by doing that, it would just and often shock people. Because they wouldn't be expecting it. And a look is one thing and a smile is another thing. But then if you can say the right thing in that first 10 seconds that you've got someone's attention, just to put them at ease and relax, then, and that's where my quick wit suddenly became a superpower of mine. And it's, thank God I've got that sense of humor and that quick wit and that ability to put people at ease. Because it's just, I flipped the tables on people really quickly, but in a positive way. And that
what were your go-tos? Is that right to ask?
It's all instinctive.
So it all depends. In the moment.
It's always in the moment. You know, I think I can be quite a funny person, but I'm not that good at telling jokes. You know, it's like I get up on stage and do talks, but I love the Q&A section at the end because I think that's where the most magic comes out, because it's not rehearsed or performed. You know, it's not a performance, it's just instinctively me being me, and I'm a very open person, and I don't mind letting people in. I don't have these defensive barriers up, because I just had to bring myself to people for so many decades, and
become more habitual that. I'm guessing then over the years. And we were talking about this just before we hit record, weren't we, that you know, some podcasts can be quite scripted, we've got to cover this, is that actually we're saying no, just we're just going organic. And, you know,
just go with the flow.
But as you say, what I also love is kind of what your values are about being authentically you, as you say, and not kind of put into a box for a podcast or a talk or whatever. It is interesting, isn't it, like, because you know, when you're kind of looking at how a teenage brain develops, you know, so those kind of 5 years then up until kind of 18-19 and kind of the transition points we might have during that time, you know, developmentally, socially, education wise what was the point at which you decided to travel as opposed to doing anything else? Because that interests me, you know, that you mentioned something about just living life, but I'm just wondering, was there kind of an aha moment or a gradual thing?
It was a gradual thing, really, and again it came from a kind of everyday adverse moment that impacted me. So one of the things I'm doing through my work now is trying to reverse the timeline on tough times to good times. So rather than starting with a really tough moment in your life, start with something that you're really grateful for and track it back. So my working title at the moment is like reverse engineering contentment, but it's not that catchy. And one of the things I'm super grateful for that we discussed in the planning for this is travel and it being the best education I ever had.
Oh, absolutely.
And I was like, well, where did that come from? So I started tracking it back, and the first time I went traveling that wasn't back to Ireland with my parents, or a trip to Malta or Magaluf with the lads before uni, you know, that's not really traveling or backpacking, was at the end of, I went to Central America at the end of my third year at uni, which was a placement year. Now, I'd spent that placement year back at my parents' house and working for the, you know, the, who did I work for? National Grid. It was really like not very good, inspiring placement. And the reason I took that was that I went for five jobs in the city, like all my friends. So I was studying business studies at university. And I just thought, you know, I go to university, get a job in the city, you know, have my 2 week holidays. You know, I was, you know, I was properly.
That's the plan.
The treadmill of life. And I got turned down for five placements. And I don't know if I was being discriminated against or, you know, one bit of feedback was that I had too much empathy to work in the city. So this was the year 2000 and, you know, soft skills weren't seen as great skills then.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that really knocked me sideways. But there was a day where I was going around with my university friends, and we were all looking at houses that we, you know, the Docklands and in Clapham and different areas we're going to live in. And at the end of the day, they said, look, Mark, we can't wait for you any longer. We're going to have to get a house and you haven't got a placement yet. And it hit me really hard. And I just thought, God, I've achieved so much. And now I'm out in the real world. It's, am I not going to be able to make a place myself? And my thoughts like spiraled into, you know, quite dark places, leaving and going home to my parents. And I went to bed that night and I woke up in the middle of the night and I was sleepwalking. So I've sleptwalked twice in my life when there's been something like really traumatic going on within my consciousness, but somehow it's gone inside of me. And I walked to my bedroom window, opened it, threw my quilt outside my bedroom window, first floor, down into the front garden, and then climbed and just sat on my windowsill. My little sister came home with her boyfriend from a night out and saw me, sat with my legs dangling outside the window and just lost it. And then went in screaming for my parents. My dad came and pulled me through the window. And that's the first bit I remember. Me going, it's all right, what are you worrying about? What's going on? Put me back to bed. My mum slept on the floor at the end of my bed. And then I woke up the next day and they told me what happened. And I was like, okay, I must have really been feeling that yesterday. Yeah. And that was a real like low moment for me. And now I could have looked back and something I want to forget. But that whole scenario meant that I was forced to live back at, set up a chain of events, right? You know, that I had to then go back and stay with my parents for a year, work locally, which meant I didn't have to pay rent. Suddenly come the summer, had a few thousand pounds to play with, and we weren't a rich family growing up. Then another friend says, I'm going to Central America for 5-6 weeks. You're coming with me. This would be good for you. So I can't do that. I don't know if I can cope. You know, I've just got my independence back, you know, a couple of years ago, and it's fine. We'll go together, and did it. And it just blew my mind like wide open. And I'm like, oh my God, what was I thinking about this very, very narrow kind of plan that I had for my life going forward? And my horizons were broadened.
Wow.
And that's it. Came back and I was like, I'm getting my degree. I'm getting some money together. How any? Sod the city. I don't want to change. if they want to, you know, stomp the empathy out of me, they can do one. And then boom, you know,
it's gonna be molded into something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then going to Southeast Asia was it was my place. Like, it's my region spiritually, just in terms of who they are, how they carry themselves, how they have dealt with adversity in recent times, the power of community, the letting people be, the land of smiles, all these things. Yeah. And I wanted to question
richness. Like, that's rich in a different kind of way, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
And so much of my upbringing had kind of served me to that point. But the guilt and the fear and, you know, of the Catholic religion and the rules and the arbitrary nature of all these different things, just none of it served me in terms of helping me process this intense, incredible journey that I'd been on. Whereas suddenly now I was in a place where, wow, look at how, you know, Cambodia as a people have gotten over a genocide and, you know, just a generation, not even a generation ago. And look at how they were there for each other. Look at their resilience. It just blew me away and just gave me the greatest education and understanding of what I went through and how I can live my life going forward.
Yeah. It's incredible, isn't it? Because when you kind of think of what you went through in those 5 years and in terms of how kind of you were you know, in terms of being able to socialize and do things, just the sensory changes of being somewhere and absorbing all of that, as let alone the kind of culture and then making links between it all, must have just been incredible for you and staggering. And what did it do for you going forward then? Because you traveled for a long time, and you mentioned before, you know, what did you, was it just travel to kind of look and observe, or were you ever kind of working and doing things within the places you were traveling?
Yeah, so the first time I went away was a year trip, and unfortunately six months in I spent all my money in Asia. So I got to Bali, and I'd had a real problem setting up my online banking, and I wasn't really it was the early days of online banking, budgeting too well. And when I finally got to, and you couldn't check your balance with your debit card abroad.
Stuff you take for granted now.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So I got to Bali, and then I finally got online, looked at my account. I was like, oh, I've got £180 left. Wow. That's not going to see me around to Australia. And luckily my friend who I was traveling with is in the same boat. So we were just like, that's fine. And we knew a friend in Sydney. So that was where our next flight was to. And we just went and got jobs, and then lived in Sydney for 5 months and got jobs and met unbelievable amounts of friends that was there that have been, you know, friends ever since. And just kind of living on the breadline and the edge and hustling and trying to find part-time work. And
it doesn't, that's resilience in its way, isn't it? Because you could have just gone home. The fear could have said, no, go home, play it safe. You know, get home and work. But what was it, do you think, then that made you go, well, let's just see?
I just liked living on that raggedy edge and just seeing what we were capable of. And I was 24 by that point, and, you know, super kind of energetic and, you know, a resilient age generally. And we were two kind of likely lads, and, you know, were cheeky and lovable, but got ourselves into trouble, and nothing ever bad. But I just loved the adventure of it. Yeah. And just, it's just like, I've got no other worries in the world. It's just me and surviving month by month and just getting by and having fun. It was an immense experience as well. So actually, if I'd had lots of money to keep traveling, then it was nice to have that 6 months, jump back into a semi kind of real world, and then do a bit of traveling at the end and then come home.
Did you say you did that for like 15 years or so?
Well, no. I discovered the game of poker when I got back from traveling and turned out to be like quite good at it. So then I had dreams of becoming a professional poker player because I could travel around the world doing that. It turns out it's a bit harder to be a professional poker player than I initially imagined with some of the
educate me. This is new territory for me.
Yeah, it was the golden age of poker, and, you know, it was all sort of coming online, and it was like the Wild West really. But I loved it, but I think I was becoming a bit obsessed by it, and friends were getting bored. My girlfriend at the time didn't loved it to start with, then, you know, really started to dislike it. And, you know, I was doing well early, and then, but the stress of, you know, winning or losing tens of thousands of pounds a month, started to wear off. But I love the game, and it wasn't about the gamble for me. It was about the psychology of the game. And, you know, poker is a microcosm of life in so many ways, in terms of what it teaches you, you know, not to be results orientated, really focus on making the best decisions. If something bad, like unlucky, has just happened to you in the hand before, or, you know, the day before in your life, how do you then turn up as the best version of yourself when you've got that massive emotional turmoil on you and you don't want to chase life? You don't want to chase the game of poker. These things I just loved. And I had quite a mathematical sort of brain growing up, so I understood the game really well. And, but then, my girlfriend dumped me, and it sort of broke my heart. But then again, this is another kind of reverse engineering contentment that I've done with myself to process these moments, that if she hadn't have done that, I was looking for a way to find a normal job, and I was trying to people please my girlfriend, really probably trying to keep her hanging around, whereas really my heart lay in the way of poker, and she probably knew that. So if it hadn't been for her dumping me and breaking my heart, I wouldn't have then throw myself into the career side of poker in terms of getting involved in poker media. And the timing that that happened and the timing that I decided to give this a go when it wasn't really a full-time job, no one was really doing it. Then the industry just exploded all over Europe and the world. And suddenly I was in the right place at the right time. And as the industry expanded and went global, I just was the cream that rose to the top. So immediately I was traveling around Europe, like going to Las Vegas, traveling around the world. And that lasted for, well over a decade, 13 years. So I traveled around the world, every single year, really. I was doing 40 flights a year, just going and writing, and then became a commentator. So talking about the biggest poker games. So I kind of look back now, at that moment that my heart was broken open.
Another adversity, all of the emotional.
But now it's just because of what I've got now. So when, to give you a bit more context, so when I felt ready to tell my story and to get out there, I had all the tools I needed. I've got all the tools I needed because going all the way back to when I got jumped into this media role with no qualifications for it at all. I was going to be a city boy. But because it was early and it was a world west to innovate, got the opportunity.
I was just thinking that's quite innovative. You kind of saw something or something was there. It seems to just fit with who you are as a person.
Yeah. And having a platform and an opportunity to develop storytelling and writing and journalistic skills. And then them knowing that I've got a big mouth and a big personality when technology live streaming became a thing. It's like, let's put a microphone in front of this guy. And then I got loads of years of broadcasting experience and also the kind of confidence to be this. And, I got well known, even though it was in a niche industry, and I won the biggest award I could win. Wow. And to win a media award, being visibly different.
Yes.
And being a kind of bit in front of, even though it was a niche industry, suddenly it's like I was given everything that I needed when I was ready to go. But I did set up my own video production company as well off the back of that. But all these experiences were exactly what I needed when suddenly I was ready to go out and tell my own story. And I would have had none of that if my girlfriend hadn't dumped me in, 2008. So I've just got, it's filled with gratitude and joy now.
Yeah, that's what comes across as well. I'm also known as sometimes a bit cheesy, but that sometimes things are just at the right time, even though there's adversity sometimes and difficult feelings and we have to let go of stuff and even maybe a bit of grief at stages, things that, we've had to let go or we've been forced to let go, whatever. But actually sometimes that kind of just the stars align kind of territory. And it's meant to be. And if it's all right to ask as well, then because starting to tell your story, someone could have come to you and said, tell your story. Is there something more organic about you going, it feels, or there's something about why it was a good point to start telling that story? Does that interest me, in terms of whether someone externally suggested or whether you were just organically yourself kind of going, I think I'm in a place where I do that.
Yeah, for decades, my mum's been sort of telling me,
okay,
son, when are you going to tell your story? So-and-so, one of her friends, thinks you're already living life for the second time and you need to share that with people. And it will.
Mums just know stuff. We do magic like that.
and it was never no. It was like, maybe, and one day, but I was just too busy living life.
Which is all right.
Instinctively. Yeah. I didn't give it that much thought. And then the pandemic hit. And we're all shut away from the world. And I'm looking around and I'm seeing trauma and adversity and people not really knowing how to cope with it. And then it really highlighted how little resilience that we have and how resilient had become a dirty word. And it annoyed me that it's almost like, well, you need resilience. If you had resilience, then having a more open and diverse and inclusive workplace, we wouldn't need to worry about all this stuff. You just need to be resilient. And it's almost like, if you want to be a woman in a man's world, you need to be resilient. So it was given this.
I couldn't agree more. Literally was having this conversation on LinkedIn this morning about this exact thing.
And it pissed me off because, because resilience is an amazing thing. And all these examples are brought up, they're all like man-made and
yeah, or should do, but, must
and
do.
They should, but probably were man-made, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's point. An okay time to keep it on the masculine side.
Yeah.
And yes, you shouldn't need those things, but life has other ways of throwing rocks at you, and you need to be resilient to cope with it. So let's not just give in. Yeah. So I was looking at that, and I was like, well, I know a thing or two, you know, about resilience and overcoming adversity, and I was forced to slow down, right? And me running into life, bang, 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 bang. And I wasn't running away from trauma. It was me running into life. But I wasn't looking back too much. I wasn't slowing down. It was the next thing, and I was a go-getter. And, you know, a lot of my friends were, you know, over the years, and despite what I've been through, think I'm really, really lucky. And I think we're all lucky in ways, but what set me apart was that I spotted opportunities.
I was going to say that. How does that word land with you when people, sometimes people mean well by saying you're so lucky, but just how it sits.
I kind of just laugh and really just say, well, no, I just spot opportunities and I go and take them because no one's going to land on my lap. And if they're out there, I'm going to be a go-getter. And I did that for 25 years. And then the pandemic hit, you know, I was running a video production company at the time. We lost 90% of our business.
It's hard when you're 3 days.
It was tough. I couldn't furlough myself. And so it was a real, real tough period. And we had to really, like, really dig deep into my resilience, and I had to be there for, you know, a business partner and other people. But at the same time, I was looking around the world but then I thought, okay, it's an opportunity to change my video production, to make it a vehicle that I need it to be, to do good in this world. And I was like, so I was suddenly starting wanting to have a life of, not suddenly, but, you know, relatively quickly, much more purpose and meaning and slowing down, kind of turn around for the first time really in 25, 30 years, and started to look back and going, oh my God, okay, this is, I know this is me talking about my life, but it's like, this is quite some life. There's a lot in here.
It is.
And I tried to make, you know, the company, the vehicle I need to have good. And it's just, I kept hitting kind of roadblocks, and I felt like I was maybe dragging my then growing team along with me in maybe direction that they didn't want to go in.
Yeah.
And we had lots of, it's almost like the universe was telling me every time that, you know, we almost got ourselves into a really good, stable position, something outside of our control would knock us back down again. And I was like, is this worth going? And I burned out like at least twice after the pandemic, keeping it going. And then that all came to a head at the end of 2021. And I went and saw, I was only allowed to go and see my family for one day because it's still the COVID restrictions. And I came back after Christmas Day. And I don't think I left my flat for a week. And it wasn't that I was in a depression. I was just in a deep thinking state, going, I had to, like, you know, I know I've got deep wells inside of me. And I was like, you know, like, the answers to this, even if, well, I didn't know the answers, but I knew that I needed to take action. So that, you know, week or so of really deep, you know, maybe then come back in first day of work in January and tell my leadership team, I need to leave this company. Wow. I know it's my company, but I need to spread my wings.
This is what I need.
Yeah. Okay. And I don't know what that's going to look like. I know that my story is going to be a part of it. I don't know how, but I'm jumping in between stations here with no plan. But if I stayed within the agency, it was taking up all of my capacity that I had no spare time to think of anything else. So I disappeared.
That's really profound. Yeah.
Yeah.
You knew what you didn't want, even though sometimes we don't know what we want. And I always say that to people I work with, that sometimes we get stuck because we think we have to know exactly what we want. But sometimes it's also a useful question. What don't I want? It's not this. And I'll take a risk. I'll take some time to reflect and find out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Along the way sometimes.
I disappeared off to Wales for 3 weeks and rented a house from my friend who's got holidays down there, the house down there, and just walked in the woods around reservoirs. I did put a few videos up on like LinkedIn, just sharing some thoughts, and I'd never done that before, but my team encouraged me to do it and they blew up. And I was like, okay, people probably do want to hear me talk about my stuff rather than the videos that we're making. I could have an impact here. And I just felt more and more empowered and sort of free, not even knowing what the direction was going. And I jumped in my car, and I was driving out of the place I was in. I was driving to North Wales. And when I got to, just take you back, when I got to university at the end of my 5-year recovery journey, and my parents, you know, dropped me in my university house and closed the door, and I stood in the corridor on my own, and I just kind of looked upwards, and my whole body like tingled, like more than just every hair on you, some like a whole bodily reaction. And it just felt incredible. And I was just like, you've done it, kid. Like, you bloody done it. And
you can almost kind of feel that as you're listening.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. And then again, and I look back now thinking that was the start of me, you know, running into life, and it started with university. Yeah. And
even with all those natural fears, as a psychologist, it makes me think, so many people I work with that could have kind of been paralyzed by fear, there might not take risks just in case. What if? But there's something about that. I love the running into life. Just try. Lean into all of that.
I just doubled down on risk, really. I just, if anything, was like, wow, you know, not that I, you know, recommend anyone, you know, playing with matches or anything. That was stupid risk. But in terms of, like you say, stuff can happen and you can be all right.
Yeah,
you know, and it doesn't have to be, you know, almost dying and
that 3% survival figure to being in that hallway going, wow, look where I've come, and look where I'm going.
So then, when I was driving out of that place in Wales, and I processed so much those 3 weeks, it happened again for just a second and a time in my life. As I'm driving, I got this all over body reaction again, and that was all I needed. In my body telling me, you know, you're making the right decision. And that was my 25 year period of running into life. And then it was time to turn back and look around and think. And I called my mum when I was on the M1 or something. And luckily I was in the inside lane, because I said to her, like, you know, I think she'd already knew that I was going off the fine. And I was like, I've decided blah, 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 I'm going to leave the company, I'm going to do this. And I said, it's time to tell my story. And I don't know how that's going to shape out or how it's going to impact my future career. And she was like, son, I've been waiting 20 years for this phone call.
Wow.
And it's like, and just to get that immediate
validation
is like, I nearly swerved off the road almost. I was on the motorway. It's like, okay, well, don't know how, you know, and I'm three and a half years later, I'm still trying to figure it out, but this can't be rushed.
But it's like now telling your story. It's that, I love that you said that, because sometimes that little threat brain can go, now I need to know what it looks like and how am I going to do talks and where am I going to do them? And sometimes you lose. And what you said right at the beginning and when we logged on before we hit record is that just organic, that bit of you that just wants to go, let's just see, because that's where your best you comes across. And I'm imagining that is what's going to happen. It's almost, there's a book title there, that signal, that whatever it was, that visceral thing that every now and again just comes.
Yeah.
It's a something, isn't it? I think a lot of people would have felt what I felt a moment ago when you were describing in that hallway, listening to this, whether they're watching it, wherever they are, that no matter what your brain is saying about why you shouldn't try stuff or do stuff that really matters to you, that it's value-based living, you said that before, you know, that strength of character you have, all those other wonderful character traits that just make you who you are, I think allow you to try and just go, right, let's lean into whatever this is going to look like, whatever it's going to work out like, which I just think. So what do you know, like, what's next?
Yeah, so I've been playing around with like lots of things in the last 3.5 years. You know, I came up with a really good business idea, but it was just, I think that was almost my version of rebounding into entrepreneurship, right?
Yeah.
So I'd left like one company. I thought, this brilliant idea to do this thing for young people, and it was amazing. And and then I joined a startup. I got asked to be the third co-founder of a purposeful leadership company, and they were amazing co-founders. And Nicole and Arunje, and Nicole was an extraordinary leadership coach. And we started putting on retreats and doing coaching one to one. And my story was going to be the heart of what we were doing. But a year or so into it, I started getting real kind of founder wobbles and those same kind of just doubts creeping up, and it was the alignment wasn't there.
Gut instincts. I'm such a massive advocate for
And then our second retreat, we had a last minute pullout, which meant we were odd numbers, and we really had to have like budding systems and even numbers is really important. So Nicole and this new facilitator we'd onboarded said that you don't need to host this one because we've got new facilitator now. Because I used to host the retreats, hold that space where people can explore their stories. And I love that role. But I went as a delegate and it was unbelievable. And I went in there thinking, I'm just going to really throw myself into this. And I'm pretty convinced I don't have any PTSD within me in terms of what happened, but I've seen it at the last retreat. And if anything's there, it's going to come out. And I was like, I'm going to allow
and
it
that
to.
That safe space that allows.
Yeah. I said, I couldn't be in a better space. I'm going to allow it to come out. And it didn't. I was absolutely rock solid. And I was seeing the impact that I was having on the other delegates with the way that I'd processed my own story and overcoming adversity and how I'd actually grown from the hardest things in my life and how they've become to define me in really good ways.
Yeah.
And at one point, Nicole came up to me, just grabbed both shoulders and looked me square in the eye and was like, all you need to be doing in life is inspiring people. It's all you need to be doing. And it was quite powerful to hear that from her. And we did a lot of work on core values, and mine is like connection and freedom. You know, connection with myself and with other people and how I can build it really deeply is a value and a strength of mine. How I'm connected to my story, but I'm free from it. How I want to have freedom of thought, to be able to freedom of movement while I've traveled. And I was like, if I just live my life through these values, then I'm going to be okay.
Because that's really important for listeners. I do a lot of therapy that's value based, that sometimes you put off stuff because you think you've got a goal, you've got to reach the goal, and we don't reach the goal, so we get deflated. Is that as long as you know what your values are, it also allows you to try stuff and get stuff wrong and refine it. And like you are now, you're deciding and finding out exactly what this is going to be like going forward. So if people
just to close off that little bit, but the thing was then that I couldn't run this company by living my values.
Yes.
So the irony was that the retreat was so incredible that it made me realize that I was already standing on top of my own mountain and I needed to go off and do my own thing and not necessarily hide behind, but have business partners and work behind a brand and all those things. It just needed to be Mark and his story and go out there. So ultimately brought the startup down. So yeah, it was a bit, but I needed that to be again kind of free and go.
Yeah. But that's all right. You know, that sometimes we know something's just not the right fit for us at that moment. Yeah. But you found that's another quite significant thing then, isn't it? That finding that, well, this, I know now I need to be just doing me as Mark, telling my story. And that kind of, so there might be people listening that kind of go, right, we want to hear more from you and help you in a way. So there's kind of you bringing yourself to listeners here, but also there may be people going, right, we want a piece of you. We want to know more and give you a platform. Where do you hang out? Where can people find you?
LinkedIn. I'm quite active on LinkedIn, so you can look for me on there. I started a Substack a year ago.
Make sure these are all in the show notes.
Yeah, so it's you can either search my name or it's called Making a Mark, Mark with a C.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, so it's how I was made, and it's really the Substack is me. It's the precursor to my book. So effectively I'm writing my notes for my book openly on Substack. So it's raw and some of it's like too deep, over detailed, but I wanted space for it to breathe. Yeah. And it was really what it is it's a gift to my mom and my family and my loved ones. And it's giving them the space to heal, because you know when you suffer a trauma as big as mine, you don't suffer in isolation. And it was the biggest thing that happened in all my family's lives as well, and it's something that we hadn't really talked about that much, you know, in 30 years. So even though it took 30 years later, I'm opening up and telling it from my side, and I went around and spoke to everyone individually and one-on-one before I started telling it too much, just to make sure they were okay. And not to get their permission, but just say, look, I need to go out and do this. And 100% across the board, they were supportive. And now some of those people have added their voice to my story.
Well, I've just come up with an idea of whether it's useful for us to do another episode at some point with that.
Yeah.
It would be the kind of bringing in that, the other element to the story, because it's too much for one podcast episode. It There's is. So many things I want to ask you, but that, have a think, because quite often I've had people come back on again, or even a third time. I've had kind of little mini series of people that, that element of your story, them, the kind of bringing those elements together.
Absolutely. I think we've got to a lovely point where it's kind of up to the point of like, well, now what's next for you? And now I can talk, you know, we can go on and I can talk about, what's coming next. And, you know, how an entire philosophy has come out of me just writing my own story. It's like being like my Substack journey has been like journaling on steroids, and you know, this whole philosophy is emerging from it, which is going to go through my book, which I then want to turn into a podcast. Sorry, I'm going to compete with on the adversity front.
Absolutely, do it. I always say that it's never competing, it's just people getting their stuff out there, and we should always just lift each other up. And
definitely, no, we could be like Savile Rowe.
Not benefit from hearing about adversity and learning from it. So I know you give them loads of stuff, but if there is one little adversity takeaway you could leave us with on this episode, and then hopefully I'll be getting you on again and again, what might that be?
I think if it's you going through the adversity, it's really tapping into who you are. I think your darkest moments gives you the freedom and the opportunity to just show up as your real self. And that in a way is empowering, because when things are going well, you know, you turn up through various personas, but you've got to be there for yourself. So see it as a gift, an opportunity to learn who you really are, because the real you will need to show up to get through that period of adversity. If you're helping someone else go through adversity, don't try and be a savior. Pity and sympathy are checks then are not going to be able to cash. What you need to be doing is empowering them to make them understand that authentic side of them. And then those two things combined is what my story had. And that's where just magic and growth can come from.
Well, that's what I'd like to do in another episode. I'm going to be emailing you the kind of, how can other people support? Kind of, you know, how was it for family, friends generally, but also what might someone supporting someone need to, I haven't covered that yet. I think that would be great.
Make some notes.
Mark, absolutely. I'm like, you know that I will follow that up. Mark, thank you so much for coming on. It's just, I've been blown away, and I had a literally hairs on the back of the neck moment. I had that tingle moment then, just wow, that hallway. That's pretty profound. There's almost an image there that needs to be developed, book cover, whatever. That's
definitely
pretty profound. Thank you so much for coming on, and
thank you so much.
Listen out for Mark coming on again, and I can't wait to read your book either. And we need to meet in person soon. You're only down the road, so definitely. I'm always in Brighton, so we need to meet up.
Let's do it.
In person. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I love to hear from you.